Hi, I'm Mike Kozer, and welcome to the Season 2 finale of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
Join us now for another Brooklyn ball game here at Ebbets Field, Brooklyn, USA.
Greetings, baseball fans. This is Mel Allen greeting you from Yankee Stadium in New York City.
Hello, everyone, with Bob Prince and Nellie King. This is Gene Osborne speaking to you from Forbes Field in Pittsburgh.
Well, friends, here we are back at the Polo Grounds in New York City.
We're underway in the first of a twilight doubleheader at Tiger Stadium.
And it's baseball here at Crosley Field.
Just the start of things. So pull up a comfortable chair. If you want to take your shoes off, go ahead. Wiggle your toes, and we hope you'll have a cold shape or two throughout the evening.
Andre Dawson finished his career with 2,774 hits and 438 home runs. Hawk, who was the 1977 Rookie of the Year, was an 8-time All-Star, NL MVP, 8-time Gold Glove winner, 4-time Silver Slugger Award winner, and a 2010 inductee into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And he's our guest today on the Season 2 finale of the Lost Ballparks podcast.
A standing ovation on his final home appearance this year.
Andre Dawson.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Gotcha. That's perfect. Hey, listen, I really appreciate you taking time today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So in 1966, you were a 12-year-old living in South Florida, and like many kids from that era, you would save up every nickel and dime you could find or earn and make a trip to the local convenience store to buy a pack of baseball cards and rip those things open. Who were some of the players that you loved to collect and that you would get excited about finding inside a pack of Topps baseball cards?
Well, it was probably the stars at the time. People like Hank Aaron, Mickey Mantle, Willie Mays, Yogi Berra, Herman Killebrew, just to name a few. And I was very anxious to open a pack and see what particular player I would come up that day. And I tried to save as much money. I tried to buy them on an everyday basis. That's how big of a collector I was during that time. Whatever happened to those cars? Now, that's another question.
Yeah. Your Uncle Curtis was a fan of the Dodgers.
That's who I remember being a fan of. Back during the Koufax Drysdale days, I think I can recall their lineup, Wes Parker, Billy Grabowicz, Manny Mota, Willie Davis, Willie Crawford, Tommy Davis.
You would find yourself in a parking lot somewhere or someone's backyard or your own backyard with a broomstick and some rocks, and you would recreate the Dodgers lineup in your head and pretend like you were playing a game. Is that right?
That's correct. And of course, the Dodgers would always win. And I developed a knack for being a switch hitter because they had switch hitters on the team. So I could hit rocks with a broomstick or mop handle, both left-handed and right-handed. I knew some of the lineups of the other clubs just from studying the box scores. So, but always the Dodgers would play, it would be either the Giants, the Pirates, because of, you know, the teams that they had with Clemente's, the Stargills, and it would be some of the American League teams. I would do an imaginary World Series also against the Yankees, because I knew that lineup, but the Dodgers would always win, of course.
And you and your friends would play a game called Stinger Marie. What is Stinger Marie?
Stinger Marie was, you had one swing, you either hit the ball or you miss it. If you missed it, you had to run because the catcher could throw the ball and hit you, and that meant that you were out. And if put the ball in play, of course, it was like, okay, you run the bases, it's either sing a double or you hit it far enough, you had to get a home run. That was Stinger Marie.
Your nickname Hawk didn't come in the major leagues. You actually had that nickname from the time you were young, thanks to your uncle Matthew?
Matthew Napier, yeah. He was a pitcher, men's league team, and being a youngster, of course, I would watch the games. Usually it was on the bench. I could sit on the bench. I did have the liberty to do that. After games or practice, he would summon me to third base, and he would hit me fungos. And he said, don't really see the fear of the baseball in you as a kid so young. He says, if anything, you appear to attack the ball like a hawk. And for whatever reason, he started calling me the Hawk, and it stuck all of those years. My family nickname, however, was Pudgy. I don't know why, because I was never really a fat kid.
Wasn't that like a friend of the family who put you on his shoulder or something and just looked back and said, hey, Pudgy, or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I ran into his sister at another friend's birthday party, and I hadn't seen her in over 40 years. And it was her brother babysitted me, actually, and he was the one that gave me the nickname Pudgy.
Which is funny, because anybody who spent a day with you, Andre, in your entire life knows that you are the furthest thing from that.
Well, I can't say for the last 2 years with the pandemic. I put on my pandemic 10, 12, whatever you want to call it, but I was always adamant about workouts and keeping an eye on physique and that sort of thing, even post-career. And yes, it was. I was never really a fat kid.
No, your workouts are legendary for sure. Out of high school, you were undrafted. You decided then to attend Florida A&M University, but had to actually walk on the team. Some folks may look at your Hall of Fame career, Andre, and think, well, I bet that this guy had it easy from the start. But that's not the case. I mean, you had to work for everything you got.
Yeah, it was a situation where actually coming out of high school, I had knee surgery and I didn't get any scholarship offers. I attended Florida A&M as a walk-on, made the team as a freshman, made the starting lineup as a freshman. And I dealt with a lot of issues even after I got drafted with the knees themselves. Playing on the AstroTurf, I was told that at the outset, you'd be lucky if you played 4 years. That was, I think, the average career lifespan of a major leaguer. And I had to endure years of playing on the AstroTurf, the wear and tear to the knees. I had 12 knee surgeries during the course of my career. You know, I just had to bite the bullet. And the one thing I didn't really take for granted was the fact that I was blessed with the talent, with the ability, but the realization was you got to go in, you got to put the time in just to stay on top of the game and to stay competitive. And I set a goal. I set a goal to play 15 years. And, you know, that was in itself, again, another far and remote dream. And once I got to year 15, it was like, hey, I still have, I think, something left. And before I knew it, I was around year 20. But at that point, I just realized that the wear and tear had really taken its toll. And I had put my body through a lot of punishment. And I look back at it, I wouldn't change anything. I would do it the same way. The end result was I was able to give the uniform back as opposed to having it taken away. And of course, yeah, now I'm sort of at the point where I'm paying for it. Like I said, I would tell an individual, make your money, make it as quick as you can. I wouldn't advise you to play 20 years plus because somewhere along the lines later in life, you're going to pay for it.
Throughout college, your grandma, who was so important throughout your life, sent you letters on a regular basis at school. Those notes of encouragement, I think, kept you centered and grounded. She used to say, put God first and get on your knees at the end of each day. Can you talk about what those letters of encouragement meant?
I was homesick at the outset, and my grandmother meant everything to me. She provided me with a lot of early teachings. And like you said, she told me, hey, baseball was recreation, but the education is first and foremost. And that's going to be your stepping stone in life. That's something you really won't ever have taken away from you. But that's what your focus got to be, especially early on. And I just look back at all of those letters, and she would write me about 3 times a week. Of course, obviously, I would write back. A lot of them started along the lines of the same thing. I'm thinking about you. Hope all is well. And there would be a Bible verse or a scripture included, and she would say, be thankful of your blessings even before you receive them. I had to get down on my knees every night before I went to bed and just pray to God for guidance each and every day. And that's what she meant to me. I could say anything, talk about anything to her, and she always seemed to say the right thing, not really stroking me in a sense, but telling me the things that I needed to hear.
During your junior year of college, the Montreal Expos began to take notice, and so did the Chicago Cubs. And Buck O'Neill, a former Negro League star and future Baseball Hall of Famer, was coming to your games to scout you.
Yeah, I didn't really know who he was. I would see him sitting in the bleachers with a little notepad. And I was informed later on, of course, by my college coach who he was. There were other scouts in attendance, my not knowing that they were scouts. I really didn't have any inkling at the time that, hey, these are people that are out watching you. And yes, Buck O'Neill did scout me. There were 2 scouts from the Expos that came out. The others, I don't know who they were, but it was interesting in a sense. I went through the draft. I was only invited to a tryout by the Montreal Expos prior to the July 75 draft. And I just didn't hear from anyone. The Expos drafted me in the 13th round. And I can recall having conversations with Buck later on, and he did put a lot of emphasis on the fact that he made me an aware to the Cubs organization. But, you know, for whatever reason, nothing manifested as a result of that. I was drafted later by the Expos.
Playing rookie ball in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. That, first of all, it's a long way from Florida. It's a long way from the big leagues. You and your team would routinely, I think, take 10 plus hour bus rides to get to the next game. And in 1975, there obviously there's no iPhones, there's no iPods, not even a Sony Walkman at that point. There was just one 8-track cassette player on your bus, I think. And maybe the only tape at that time that you guys had was a Beach Boys greatest hits. Now, look, I love the Beach Boys as much as anybody, but after 10 hours, you probably to this day can't listen to a Beach Boys song.
Oh, man, you knew all of the songs word for word. You heard those songs in your sleep. That's what it was.
Yes,
we had the bus trips from Lethbridge to Idaho Falls, then some to Great Falls. And, you know, you slept for the most part because you had to go through the mountains. And you obviously, the bus would be driven at a speed that, you know, had to be conducive to how you had to travel up in the mountains, going around the curves and the cliffs and so on and so forth. So you got to hear a lot of that Beach Boys tape, but
I'm just picturing you with your eyes closed on the bus and like singing Good Vibrations, you know, for the 800th time.
It was amazing, but, you know, it was our form of entertainment, and it was what got us through those bus trips.
Fortunately, you weren't traveling on minor league buses very long. On September 11th, 1976, you were one of the September call-ups for the Expos, and you made your major league debut at Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh. Was this the first major league baseball game you had ever been to, or had you been to one growing up?
I saw some of the Atlanta Braves games when I was in college, when we would go to Georgia from Tallahassee to Atlanta, of course, to play some of the local colleges there.
Okay.
If it was a day game, we were provided tickets to go to a night game to watch the Braves play. And I got to see a little bit of Dusty Baker, some of Hank Aaron in his later years. And those were some of the early games that I got to see prior to maybe seeing a game or two as a youngster with the Baltimore Orioles when they were training here in South Florida out at spring training at Miami Stadium. So I got to see some Orioles games, exhibition games, that is, but only regular season games when I was in college. And those were the games of the Braves.
Walk me through going into Three Rivers and coming into the game, your first major league experience. Here you are playing on the same field with some of the guys you grew up watching, Willie Stargell.
Yeah, Willie Stargell, Rennie Stennett, Richie Hebner, just to name a few, the best players in the world. And that's when it dawned on me that, hey, now your dreams have been answered and you're a big leaguer. And these individuals reminded me that, okay, you're with the big time now. I just had to cherish that moment for what it was. And when I look back at it, there was a big, tall, rangy left-hander on the mound, John Candelaria.
And a big left-hander, John Candelaria, keeps a fastball away from right-handers, keeps a curveball away from right-handers.
And he was the very first pitcher that I faced. I think I got a couple of ABs. I went 0 for 2 against him.
The Expos hitting coach, by the way, in 1976, was Cleveland legend Larry Doby. Doby, who was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1998, was the first black player to break the color barrier in the American League when he joined Cleveland in 1947. Did Larry share any details with you about what that was like?
Larry never really talked about his time as a Negro leaguer, as a big league ball player, being the first player in the American League, African-American. He just had the younger players gravitate to him, and he looked at each and every individual for what their makeup was and assuring them that the road to the major leagues, just taking that opportunity and making the most of it. And that's what I was most grateful with him for. I do recall him at the outset saying, listen, you're in Montreal. I'm going to let my daughter take you out to dinner and show you the city. He said, I'd never done this with any other player, but I realized I can probably trust you. Of course, I got a big kick out of that. So his daughter's name was Kimberly, and she did take me out. She showed me a little bit of Montreal. We had dinner, and I was gracious for him for, you know, reaching out to me in that regard.
That month, by the way, you played your very first game at Montreal's Jerry Park.
The game is underway here at Jerry Park.
What were your first impressions of Jerry Park, a unique little ballpark?
Well, to me, it didn't appear to be the same kind of environment, ballpark, that I had envisioned when I, you know, played on the road, playing in New York, playing in Philadelphia, and playing in Pittsburgh at the outset. Jerry Park seemed to be a little bit more open, very windy, very cold.
Yeah, it really could get frigid. We had Dave Van Horn, who was the longtime Expos broadcaster from 1969 to 2000. He was on the podcast earlier this season. He said that their second baseman at shortstop would take extra precautions.
The sharp wind that came across the opening between the left field bleachers and the left field stands, there was an opening there, and wind came blowing through there right across the diamond. And the shortstop, Bobby Wine, and the second baseman, Gary Sutherland, actually put cotton in their right ears because that wind was so cold and so harsh that they were having trouble maintaining concentration out there and not getting headaches. So they played with cotton balls rolled up and put into their right ears to protect against that wind in early April.
I remember that at the outset because it was September. And my very first game there, I think it was against the Phillies. And I got the opportunity to get on base and be introduced to a great ball player, Dick Allen. The one thing I remember about Dick, as cold as it was, he didn't have sleeves on. And his arms, his hands were very ashy. And he said to me, young blood, it's very, very cold out here, isn't it? And that's just what he said. I just remember those initial encounters. It kind of left me in awe because I got the opportunity to talk to and have some things shared with me, some of the greatest players ever to play the game.
In 77, the Expos moved into Olympic Stadium.
A new era was about to begin, the era of artificial turf and exploding electronic scoreboards, of huge crowds and the happy wanderer.
And more than 57,000 were on hand to watch that first game. What did you like about Olympic Stadium versus Jerry Park? Obviously, the size is much different. You're, I would think, a little warmer, even though the roof had not been covered at that point.
Well, it was still very cold, and it was AstroTurf. But I can recall we had a good fan base, especially once we started winning. I was a hockey town, and they were still learning the game. But they did come out and support the team, especially during the summer months. But opening day was a little bit different because as spacious as Olympic Stadium was, you had fans from deep right center field to deep left center field. And as you called it, 50-some-odd thousand plus. That was, for me, it was a sight to see.
Those first years in Montreal, your mom would come visit from time to time. She would stay at your apartment on St. Catherine Street while you were at the game and cook you dinner so you could come back to a nice home-cooked meal. What did she make for you and what were some of your favorites that, like, when you would walk through the door, you'd go, oh, this is what we're having tonight. I can't wait.
Oh, how I welcome that. Montreal was known for its restaurants, but a different culture, different type of menu, per se, for me. It wasn't like you go to restaurants, especially when you were in the States. But to get that home cooking that, you know, I grew up with and that I was used to on just a small basis when my mom would come up and visit, I welcomed that and looked forward to it. And I can remember all of my favorites she would cook, whether it was meatloaf with broccoli, mashed potatoes and gravy, or if it was fried chicken with yams, collard greens, and...
What about her peach cobbler?
I can't say enough for that because that was my favorite. She was a cake baker / pastry chef. That was her job when I was younger, and I never had a dessert that she made that I didn't like. So I would always cherish the desserts prior to eating whatever dinner was, and never knew how I was able to manage my weight all of those years, but yes, I was a big dessert lover, and the peach cobbler was outstanding.
You finished your rookie year with 19 home runs, 65 RBIs, and a .282 batting average, and win the 1977 Rookie of the Year, becoming, by the way, the first Expos player in franchise history to win that award.
Yeah, I got off to a slow start. I was being platooned with a veteran left-handed hitter, Dale Unser, And I really didn't get the opportunity to start until around, start on an everyday basis, that is, until around early June when I hit my first home run off of a right-hander Buzz Capper in Atlanta, Fulton County Stadium. And I got to start following game against another right-hander. And before I knew it, I was playing on an everyday basis. And I was able to get a rhythm going, get locked in, and go on and have a pretty productive rookie season and be awarded with the Rookie of the Year award.
In 1981, you were selected to your first All-Star game.
Hitting sixth from the Montreal Expos. He has 13 homers and a .325 average this season. Center fielder Andre Dawson.
What stands out to you about that experience at Cleveland Municipal Stadium? I mean, here you are walking into the locker room with all these guys. You still admire them, right? But now they're your teammates.
Well, you get the opportunity to play across from them as the opposition. Then you get the opportunity to share the same clubhouse with them. And they're the superstars of the game. And this is your first All-Star game. And for the most part, a lot of these players are repeat players. And they're the elite. And you're in awe. You're in awe because the fact that not only do you get to share that locker room, but the president is going to walk through and he's going to greet you.
President Reagan at the time, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just one of those awe moments that obviously you are grateful and you feel a lot of gratitude being selected and just being to share that experience that one particular day. And you look back on it, and I was in eight of those. And they were all special. I can honestly say that. Neither stood out more so than any other. Maybe Montreal, because of, you know, being in my own home ballpark and sharing that with about six plus of my teammates. But they were all special, and they all meant a great deal to you.
By the end of 81, you helped lead the Expos to their first playoff appearance, Game 1 of the NLDS versus the Phillies.
And their talented center fielder, Andre Dawson, second to Schmidt in home runs. Dawson combines his power with speed and a golden glove. The Montreal Expos, the first Canadian entry in the playoffs.
You go 2-for-4 with a triple off Steve Carlton.
Hit well to right. Nate McBride has to play the carom. Dawson going for three. He's got it. Carlton backed up the throw, and Dawson a leadoff triple in the fifth.
You end up going 2-for-4, and behind a strong pitching performance from Steve Rogers, the Expos take Game 1 and go on to win the NLDS in 5 against the Phillies, giving the city of Montreal not just its first playoff victory, but its first playoff series victory.
Yeah, those fans, they embraced that, and they went wild. They were used to the Canadiens winning and, you know, getting to the playoffs. I think it was special to see that moment with baseball, because they were still learning the game. And it was a special moment, I must say. Yes, we did win in the miniseries against the Phillies. We lost to the Dodgers, of course, who went on and I think they won the World Series. But that was an exciting series. We were one, I think, pitcher out away from going to New York, playing the Yankees in the World Series.
And so for the first time this year, Rogers comes in out of the bullpen. It's his game. Ninth inning, tied at one.
I mean, the crazy thing is, Steve Rogers comes into that game having won three playoff games in 1981, two against Steve Carlton and one earlier in the NLCS. And he gets the first two outs in the top of the ninth inning, including a long fly ball that Ron Say hit to the left field wall that Tim Raines ended up catching.
Two out. Rick Monday.
Monday hits the home run, puts the Dodgers up 2-1. And all but seals their victory. And look, I don't think there's anybody in Olympic Stadium who didn't think Steve Rogers was going to close that game out. And the Expos were going to find a way to score a run in the bottom of the ninth inning.
We had our bags packed. And when that didn't happen, that was a big letdown. There was a moment, an experience that you'll never forget, because it meant going to the World Series if you won the game. After 81 was special in that regard, because it was the first such opportunity for me and a lot of my teammates.
After 10 years in Montreal, many great moments with guys like Gary Carter, Cromartie, Ellis Valentine, Steve Rogers, and others, you made the move finally to natural grass. You became a Chicago Cub.
The big name in sports tonight is Andre Dawson.
The first significant free agent to change teams outside of Ray Knight. The Cubs have got Andre Dawson, a one-year deal with $500,000 guaranteed.
Should have been a surprise to no one, considering up to that point in your career, I think your average at Wrigley Field was like close to 350 or something. I mean, you knew you wanted to be a Cub But Dallas Green, who I think was running the team at the time, wasn't convinced the deal was going to get done. So in an effort to make his decision an easy one, you did something unprecedented. You gave him a blank contract and said, fill in the numbers and let me prove what I'm worth to you.
Montreal had made me an offer, but it was an offer that to me was a slap in the face. And they felt that I couldn't turn it down because no one else was going to make me an offer or negotiate with me. So there were only two particular teams that I had in mind. That was Chicago and Atlanta, because Atlanta was closer to my home in Florida. It was still the National League and a natural playing surface. But I knew and realized that I had always enjoyed daytime baseball. And Wrigley Field was exceptional. I mean, the Bleacher Bums, they had a national following. They had Harry Carey.
Hello again, everybody.
And they were maybe about 3 or 4 years removed from the playoffs. And they had the nucleus of that team still intact. So if I was going to play more than half the games in that scenario during the daytime, it was natural for me. I looked at it like it was spring training. You get up, you go play the game, and you enjoy your afternoon, and you look forward to getting back to the ballpark the following day. So we had this idea. We give the Cubs a blank contract and just move on from there. And they really didn't know what to make of it. And I think Dallas honestly wanted to give me a proposal to turn down so that he could remove himself from that situation. But he didn't really think that I was going to accept it. And it kind of shocked him that I did accept it.
I think the conversation I had with Andre face to face convinced me that he wasn't. He was very, very serious about playing in Wrigley Field and playing for Chicago.
So here it is, 1987. You are a Chicago Cub. You're 0-10 coming into a game at Busch Stadium in St. Louis. And you come to the plate with the bases loaded against Todd Worrell.
Worrell goes into the stretch. Here's the pitch. Swung on, and there's a drive! Deep to left! Way back is called on! Gone! Grand slam home run for Andre Dawson on the first pitch from Todd Worrell. Andre Dawson picks up his first hit of the series as he drills it over the fence and left. A grand slam home run.
I don't think I started the game. I got off to a slow start. I actually had a good spring. And I think we got to Chicago. I may have pressed a little bit trying to prove some things, but that started things to roll in for me. It appeared that from that standpoint, things just started to happen on an everyday basis. And the Bleacher Bums obviously, of course, played a part. You know, they were salaaming. They welcomed me from day one, and they made it comfortable for me to go out and just relax and enjoy the game. And I think once I hit that home run against Worrell, that kind of got things going for me.
Yeah, because you then head back to Montreal to play at Olympic Stadium, but this time as a Cub, and you go 7-for-12.
Dawson drives this one back into center field. Nichols a long way to go, and that ball is gone. Home run for Andre Dawson. A two-run home run, and the Cubs are on top 6-0.
Hey, welcome home, Andre Dawson.
Well, I circled that immediately on the calendar once I saw that on the schedule, and I knew going back there would be a lot of emotions. And for me, it was kind of bittersweet, the reception that I got, because I was booed, actually. And I think a lot of it was out of frustration from the fans. The fans didn't really understand quite the collusion process. And they didn't really know what exactly at all that had transpired as a result of that offseason. But I just think that, you know, they were frustrated in a sense. But as I mentioned, I was starting to warm up a little bit at the plate, and the booing really ignited me. It ignited me, and it made me look forward to the games that we played there. And the rest of the season would be sort of a carryover to what had transpired.
Yeah, so April 29th then, you go 5-for-5 in a game against the Giants.
On a 2-2 pitch. Into right center by Maldonado, all the way back to the wall, and Andre Dawson has them all. He homered in the first, doubled in the third, single in the fourth, and he's tripled here in the sixth.
Hit for the cycle.
By that time, it was still a little bit cool in Chicago, but Wrigley Field, just the fan base just ignited me. And that huge ovation I would get, the salaaming every day that I would go out to my position, it was just a love affair that started between myself and the Wrigley faithful. And once I got going, when things sort of started to warm up and heat up for me. It was one of those awe moments that this is what I, you know, had dreams of this season being like. I didn't set any goals. I dedicated that season to my grandmother who had passed back in February, I want to say. You know, every time something happened from a positive standpoint, I just look up to the heavens and I'd point and I knew that she was looking down on me and everything was for her.
And you win the 1987 NL MVP beyond a career year. I want to fast forward just a second to 1991, the All-Star Game being held at Toronto Sky Dome. And you're making your eighth and final appearance in the Midsummer Classic, and you come face to face with one of the hardest throwing right-handers maybe in baseball history, Roger Clemens.
Rossin corks at the center. How far did you hit that one, Andre? Look out wherever you are. What a home run. It's 3-2. That ball went more than 450 feet, I would guess, Tim.
Well, all you have to do is watch the reaction of Ken Griffey Jr. Roger the Rocket Clemens was aptly named after that pitch. What a rocket.
Yeah, Roger, obviously, you know, one of the greatest players to play the game, pitchers, that is, to pitch in the big leagues. And I would later become a teammate of his, but not really knowing a great deal about him other than the fact that, you know, he was a power guy. And he believed in his fastball. He threw a pitch kind of borderline up and in, and it knocked me down. And it didn't faze me in any way. I just got up, dusted myself off. And I'm geared into the fastball. I'm thinking, you know, he's not going to come breaking ball, obviously. Maybe a pitch up and in is to set up another pitch. So I'm thankful that got a guy out there who has that mindset that he believes in strength on strength. He's going to come right back at me. And sure enough, he threw a fastball out over the plate. And it was to my liking. And I hit a home run off of him straight away center field off of the restaurant.
I think it's still flying somewhere.
You know, I knew I got all of it. And it was no doubter. And not long after that, we were teammates. We never even talked about it. I just acknowledged the fact that it was my first ever All-Star home run. You enjoy the moment for what it is.
By 93, you're in a Red Sox uniform with Roger Clemens playing at Fenway Park. And I think long before you played a game at Fenway, you would let your mind race as to what it must be like to hit a home run over that green monster. Well, on April 15th, 1993, you hit a ball over that giant green wall that sailed into the Boston night.
Takes a drive to left field. It's well hit. It is going. It is gone. Home run number 400 for Andre Dawson.
Did it live up to the expectation? How did it feel hitting a ball over the green monster at Fenway Park?
Well, I was there for all of maybe 2 weeks before I actually hit the green monster. I was kind of tied between what is it actually like, because when I stepped foot on the grounds in Fenway, the green monster just seemed like it was right there. I mean, wow, I'm like, you know, the left field wall is that close. This is going to be a lot of fun. And I hit a home run over it, but it took 2 weeks before I actually hit the green monster. And that wasn't fun because I got only a single out of it. Now I'm saying to myself, you know what? If this is what it's going to be like, I've hit some balls pretty hard that probably would have gone out of some ballparks, but I only wind up getting a single out of it. This is not going to be a lot of fun. But I will say this, Fenway Park was a lot of fun because, you know, it was one of the older ballparks, and I got the opportunity to play in it, and I look at it like Wrigley Field. It has a lot of intricate, you know, angles, and the fan base is very similar. And it's one of those ballparks that you marvel at, you know, because you're going to get the crowds, you're going to get the support. And it's just a little bit different from, you know, all of the modern ballparks or all of the other ballparks, the newer ballparks that were being built. And I got the opportunity to play in that ballpark.
On January 6, 2010, you started your day by making a drive to visit the grave sites of your mom and grandma. And then you were hopeful that you would soon be receiving a call from the Baseball Hall of Fame. The announcement was to be made at 2 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, you still had not received a call. At 1:20, still nothing. A few minutes before 2 p.m., the phone rang.
Well, I was waiting on the call, obviously, to come from New York. I knew if I got the call, that meant that, okay, you were in the Hall of Fame. If you didn't get the call, then you weren't going to get in. And I hadn't gotten the call, and I just felt that, okay, well, 2010, year nine was my window of opportunity because everyone that was ahead of me, I was in. There was no one for me to hurdle. But sitting around, I didn't invite anybody over to share that moment because I was uncertain as to whether or not it was going to happen. And I didn't want to be disappointed. I didn't want any family to be disappointed. I just waited and waited. And once I did get the call, however, I stood there as the phone was ringing and I noticed the 212 area code where the call was supposed to come from. And I let the phone ring and I'm staring at the phone and my wife, the ringing three times, she said, "You're not going to answer it." You know, really coming from New York, I picked the phone up and of course, I was the president of the Baseball Writers Association, informing me that I had been selected to, as a lone recipient, of course, to get into the Hall of Fame that particular year.
It's incredible. And then, you know, the weekend of the Hall of Fame, there you are with Hank Aaron at lunch. It had to feel surreal.
I was about to eat lunch. My family and I went down in the restaurant at the Otisaga and seated at a table, both Willie and Hank Aaron. And I was seated by the hostess. And I said to my son, I said, "Do you know who that is?" Obviously, he didn't have a clue. And I said, "That's two of the greatest players ever to play the game." And I said, "It's Hank Aaron and it's Willie Mays." He looked in awe because he, you know, had heard me talk about them. And as I looked over, I noticed that I got a nod from Hank. And he waved for me to come over. And he said to me, he said, "Feel free to join us if you would like to." And what a moment. And I went over and I said to my wife, my son and my daughter, "We've been asked to come over and have lunch with Hank and Willie." And it was a moment, you know, you can't really describe. And I'll never forget that. And it just made the welcoming process of having to endure all of those Hall of Famers who I would encounter later on, that experience, much more enlightening for me.
Wow, amazing. Well, listen, Andre Dawson, I want to thank you for the time reflecting on your Hall of Fame career, 2,774 hits, 438 home runs, Rookie of the Year, 8-time All-Star, NL MVP, 8-time Gold Glove winner, 4-time Silver Slugger, one of the select few members of the 400-300 club, 400 home runs, 300 stolen bases. It's been an honor and a privilege to spend some time with you today talking about your career. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And just remember, we can talk anytime.
Man, I'll tell you what, I was lucky enough to watch him play in his prime. And Andre Dawson, first of all, he had a rifle arm. And if you were a pitcher, you did not want to see number 10 walk up to the plate because he could change the outcome of a game with one swing of a bat. And I've heard for a long, long time that Andre Dawson, like in real life, outside of baseball, is just a really good guy. Yeah, I can confirm that that is definitely true. Really enjoyed talking to him today. A quick reminder, we're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, so you can follow us on any of those platforms. If you're not already, just search Lost Ballparks. And if you haven't subscribed to the podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever platform you're using, you can subscribe now for free. That way you'll never miss an episode. Special thanks to our producers, Briggs Buckingham, Mandy Zaflakis, Mike Dunn, Michael Ortman, and Xavier Guerra. In between season 2 and season 3, we'll be taking the next few weeks off. Cannot wait to share with you what we've got coming up. Thank you again for listening, and thank you, as always, for supporting the Lost Ballparks podcast.